From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview with the author Allison Pearson, whose new novel, How Hard Can It Be?, continues the story of Kate Reddy, whose story began in Pearson's first book, I Don't Know How She Does It. Pearson is also the author of the novel I Think I Love You. She was named Newcomer of the Year at the British Book Awards for her first book. She has written for The Daily Telegraph, The Times UK, The Daily Mail, Time, The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Observer, and countless other publications. She has won many awards, including Columnist of the Year, Critic of the Year, and Interviewer of the Year. I Don't Know How She Does It became a major motion picture starring Sarah Jessica Parker in 2011. I think Oprah Winfrey called it the Bible for mothers, working mothers. I don't have the quote in front of me, but Oprah said really great things about the book. Allison Pearson lives in Cambridge, England, with the New Yorker film critic Anthony Lane and their two children. Here's a little information about her new book. Kate Reddy had it all. A nice home, two adorable kids, a good husband. Then her kids became teenagers. Read Monsters. Richard, her husband, quit his job, taking up bicycling and therapeutic counseling, drinking green potions, dressing head to toe in Lycra, and spending his time and their money on his own therapy. Since Richard no longer sees a regular income as part of the path to enlightenment, it's left to Kate to go back to work. Companies aren't necessarily keen on hiring 49-year-old mothers, so Kate does what she must, knocks a few years off her age, hires a trainer, joins a women's returners group, and prepares a new resume that has a shot at a literary prize for experimental fiction. When Kate manages to secure a job at the very hedge fund she founded, she finds herself in an impossible juggling act, proving herself, again, at work, dealing with teen drama and trying to look after increasingly frail parents as the clock keeps ticking toward her 50th birthday. Then, of course, an old flame shows up out of the blue, and Kate finds herself facing off with everyone from Russian mobsters to a literal stallion. Surely it will all work out in the end. After all, how hard can it be? When I spoke with Allison earlier today, I began by asking her if it was at all intimidating to continue to write about Kate Reddy, given that I Don't Know How She Does It was such a huge hit. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I think it would be intimidating, but it's been a long time. It's been, 15 years. And I really didn't want to do a sequel to I Don't Know How She Does It. I mean, it had been a wonderful success, and I felt I'd written everything I had to say about work and motherhood was crammed into that book. It was bursting with all my ideas, and I really didn't want to write a sequel. And then I remember that there was a woman actually in your part of the country who came up to me after a book signing, and she had this little smile on her face, and she said, I hate to tell you this, Miss Pearson, she said, but little kids are the easy part. Just wait until Kate has teenagers. And of course, when you've got little kids, when you're in the projectile vomiting years, you really can't imagine, I don't think. I think the way nature works is it keeps you in the same time frame as the age your children is. That's all you can remember. You can't really look forward or look back. I think that's very determined thing that nature does to you, really. Yeah. So I didn't want to write a sequel, and then I guess my kids became teenagers. I started seeing my friends, dealing with the challenges of what we call the sandwich generation, elderly parents running from school events to elderly parents, meanwhile hitting the menopause. So at the time when the mum's own health or has her own kind of physical and emotional challenges, she is the load bearer. And that role is just so critical when you're coming up for 50, which Kate is in this new book. So I thought this was a good time to write a sequel. I thought this is such an interesting juncture to catch up with. I found myself thinking, how's Kate doing? How's she doing? And I sort of started kind of vaguely talking to her in that way, and her voice came back loud and clear. I didn't have to strain for it.
She was very accessible to you right away.
Absolutely, immediately. Yeah, I just sat down and wrote, I never worried about getting older. And then she just, she took it from there, really. she was, you know, she just, and I think if that hadn't happened, if it had been a strain to locate her voice, if I'd felt I was straining for effect, or then I would have stopped, because I didn't want to spoil what for many people is a very special book,
yeah,
with a lot of great memories. I didn't want to write a sequel where everyone said, oh, shame, you know, shame the sequel isn't as good as the original. And I hope, and I'm touching wood here in England, that people really don't, that's not what people will feel reading this book. They'll feel it's a different book, but hopefully it has as much humor and depth as the original.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really holds up well next to the original, I have to say.
Good.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's so much fun. And very serious. You know, these subjects are very serious. Let's see. So some of the funniest observations in the book have to do with Kate's age and experience next to those of her daughter, Emily. Emily has inadvertently sent a picture of her bare behind to a friend who sent it out across the internet. That's sort of where the book opens, which is just, you know, very, we just want to know right away what's going to happen with this. So how did you come to this premise?
Well, I believe in arresting openings, because you may remember that, I don't know how she does it, begins with Kate at a similar time in the middle of the night taking shop-bought pies and beating them up to look homemade. And I think it's also kind of 2:53 a.m. Emily comes in and says that one girl in her year has asked them to compare summer tan lines, and Emily, being very trusting and innocent, has sent a picture of her bare butt, I hesitate to say it, and this has, of course, now gone viral. I was very interested. I'm very, very passionate and interested about the difficulty of parenting in the age of social media. Mm. I really don't think we've even begun to figure out how, you know, how hard it is. And that struck me. I wanted that to be one of the big themes of the book, you know, that children for the first time are inhabiting a kind of parallel world to their parents where they're inaccessible. Somebody rather brilliantly said that when it came to new technology, kids were the natives and parents were the immigrants. And I felt that's true. And I also think that it's the first time in human history when it's been the case that the children have had access to this whole world from which the parents are often excluded. Just to give you one example, my Sharon, who's my great friend, lives outside New York, and she said she had put parental controls on all the devices in her house and was feeling very kind of smug and responsible. And she said one day this computer guy came round and he said to her, I hate to tell you, Mrs. Saltz, he said, but your daughter has downloaded how to get round parental controls, and she's paid for it with your credit card. And as Kate says in the book, basically we're Stone Age people living with Bill Gates.
Yeah.
And although that is expressed, you know, as comedy, there is a, you know, there is a level of, you know, difficulty and darkness which I think underpins that. And as the book goes on, the reader, you know, comes to see some of the consequences of what's happened to Emily.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about balancing humor and serious subjects. But before we get to that, I do want to talk a little bit about your humor. This is just a little thing, but I noticed it a couple times in a row, and I thought we could talk about it, as a lot of the listeners on the show are writers. So in the prologue, Kate reflects that when she was younger, she felt that age didn't really matter. And that paragraph ends with, "And then I got older." So there's a similar moment not long after when she talks about turning 50 and how she expects it to be uneventful and serene. And then that paragraph ends, "Then Emily woke me up." These are both really funny moments. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about using timing and one-liners when you want to make both a point and a joke.
Yeah, I think it's quite hard to analyze, isn't it? Humor is such a particular thing. I mean,
right, and I can just kill it by doing that, probably.
No, it's important. And in fact, I work at those paragraphs. I mean, I just, by the time I'm finished, they're so polished, you can see your reflection in them, honestly. Mm-hmm. And one thing I feel as a comic writer is that, of course, you get, as you know, as a writer, you get marks deducted for laughter. I often think the paragraphs, I find it very easy to write the paragraphs which are the ones that make people cry, less easy to write the ones that make people laugh. Timing, I think it's just about refining, it's just about getting that beat. I mean, it's quite musical in a way, isn't it? It's getting the dum-de-dum and then da-dum, you know, it's that It's right. that kind of the dying fall at the end of a sentence that will suddenly pull you back.
Right.
What I often do is I'll write and then I'll go back and I'll really tighten it up until it's, you know, until I can predict the laugh. And certainly reading on the book tour I've just done in the States, reading out that opening chapter with where Emily comes in and reveals she's like Kim Kardashian, has decided to share her backside with the entire world. That I can tell now where the laughter comes very, very explosively. And it's a great joy to me that the moments where I deliberately, you know, wrote towards the humor are the moments where the audience really, really laughs. But I do think it's somewhat hard to describe what's happening. Maybe you as the reader can see it more clearly. I think it's about balancing. So I think in Kate's life, comedy is sometimes about trying to maintain order. You know, it's about the person being very calm and ordered, and then chaos comes punching through.
Right.
You know, it's the explosion inside the well-ordered intentions, I think. And
yeah.
I think that's probably the most of the comedy in both I Don't Know How She Does It and How Hard Can It Be comes from these situations where she's trying to perhaps live a lie. I mean, in the first book, she's trying to hide the fact she's a mother at work.
Right.
In the second book, she's trying to hide the fact that she's 50 at work or nearly 50 at work. So
right.
She decides to knock 7 years off her age to get a job at all. And then, of course, she has menopausal memory problems, so she can't even keep up with the lies she's got to tell to pretend she's 42. Now, I, as a writer, as a comic writer, I'm very attracted to those, slightly crazy situations because there's so much rich possibility for humor, I think.
Yeah, there is. Now, you said something a minute ago that just it made me think of something I've never really thought about before, and that is in writing humor, you said you work and you work and you work at it, and you really polish those paragraphs. But so that strikes me that two things might come out of that. First of all, you might really start to question whether it's funny, because once we look at something over and over and over and over, you know, I think that would make me really question whether or not I'm succeeding at what I'm trying to do. On the other hand, you get to hear the laughter when you read, whereas a lot of other writers, they don't really know how people in the audience are reacting.
Well, I have an early kind of testing panel, so I have some very close girlfriends, and I will send them stuff out as I'm writing, and then they will come back with their reactions. And if they are kind of snorting into their cereal with delight, then I know I'm okay. So I do kind of test. I do get my my TripAdvisor feedback as I go along, just to make sure it's funny. But you're right; you can start thinking, is that funny? But I do think giving it to a friend or somebody whose judgment you really respect to see if it's. I have the great screenwriter Aline Brosh McKenna, who adapted Devil Wears Prada and has written Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and so on. And
right.
she's one of my focus group. And if Aline thinks it's funny, it stays funny, basically. Yeah. So
that's a pretty good judge.
Yes.
Now, as I said a minute ago, as we've both sort of mentioned, it's funny. It's also serious. The themes in the book are also serious. You know, there are themes of menopause. There are themes of aging parents. The stuff with social media is frightening. So I'm wondering, as you worked, how did you balance humor against the very real problems that Kate is facing?
Well, you know, I think it's just my preferred method. I think I see life as, comedy and tragedy so tightly braided together that you can hardly tell where one ends and one begins. And that's how I respond to the world, I think, as a person, but also as a writer. I mean, I think that it's about laughing people into recognition, which I think is so powerful with readers. So when I Don't Know How She Does It was published, an interviewer said to me, why didn't you write a factual book about working moms? And I said, if I'd written a book called Ladies, Your Life Stinks, it would have sold four copies. But if you write a kind of uproarious comedy in which everyone can see a piece of themselves, it's somehow less kind of threatening. It's less upsetting. It's like, oh, look, let's face it. I think perhaps one of the greatest pleasures of reading is to think I'm not alone. You know,
absolutely.
Bad stuff happened to me today, but hey, look what's happening to this crazy woman here in this book. And I think that Kate enabled a lot of people to, particularly a lot of working moms, to think, oh, you know, we're all in this together. This is tough stuff people are asking us to do, and generally we're doing it well, and occasionally we drop a couple of plates. But you know what? We're still valuable. We're still worthwhile. And I did actually, all those years ago, go on Oprah, and Oprah said this is the Bible for the working mother, and that stuck with me, you know. And I think that, I think comedy somehow takes the edge. I think people are more willing to nod in recognition if it's those difficult feelings are diffused by comedy. Maternal guilt is it can be a very sharp and anguished feeling. But if you laugh at it, if somehow you laugh at it, it just makes it less sad. It makes it easier to cope with and easier to kind of to identify with the book, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, one theme that's in the book is the Me Too movement, obviously, with sending her picture out and it going viral. Mm. There's some subject matter that's sexual in nature, and the way that people are reacting and writing to her is very disturbing, a few of them. I just wondered, so you at one point say that Kate read about a discrimination case in the paper the other day, some junior accountant complaining that her boss hadn't been respectful enough in his use of language. I thought, seriously? And then she goes on to explain how much worse it used to be in the workplace than just a lack of respect. There's another moment where you write, funny how rank old sexists become charming, gallant gentlemen when you're in need of a boost, isn't it? Now, I'm going to be kind of careful how I say this, but there are some people that don't think it's appropriate to be funny about the Me Too movement. I myself sort of got shut down on Facebook when I said something that somebody thought wasn't taking it seriously enough. And I do take it, of course, very seriously. Have you gotten any feedback from people about that aspect of the book?
I haven't, not from the book. I have sometimes in my journalism. I suppose what Kate's trying to say, and right. this is true to life, and we should still be allowed to tell the truth, I think,
right.
even if it's inconvenient, which is that women who are older will have a slightly different perspective on some of these issues than women who are younger. And that doesn't mean we haven't got something to learn from younger women, but also vice versa, you know, that there is such a thing as perspective. So Kate, when she entered, I guess, what to you guys is Wall Street, over here is the City of London, was up against kind of monstrous sexism. I mean, like, you know, terrible, terrible, wicked sexism, which most of the women who I interviewed when I've been researching the books just take it. You know, they just let it wash over them because otherwise they couldn't cope with their daily lives. And that's a fact. And I wanted to write a book that was true, you know. And also it's a fact that some women I've spoken to who are older, they take the, you know, they think the taking offense where none was intended, or just at what we might see as being the normal give and take of everyday life where men and women are present, is, you know, is perhaps overstated. So the book is not saying that there are not changes that need to be made. There most certainly are, and the book is one thing, is very impassioned about the appalling ageism against women as they try to re-enter the workplace.
Yes. Yes.
But nevertheless, it says that the fact is that women of my age will look on some of the challenges faced by younger female colleagues and think, you know, literally, are you kidding? I mean, this is nothing compared, you know, that's the way it is. You know, one generation will always look at the other and think, you think you've got problems, you know. So I think that that's just an honest reflection of what someone like Kate would think.
Right, right. Another quote from the book, she says, can you be a success as a mother? People only notice when you're not doing it right. And that really resonated for me. Incidentally, I'm about Kate's age, a little older than Kate, and my kids are all grown up and out. But so I imagine that readers who are mothers really respond to this aspect of Kate's truth. And I wondered, what do you find when you meet your readers? What did they most sort of say to you about what really resonated for them?
Well, I think it is the recognition of the, you know, these particular predicaments and challenges, that some of which we've discussed already.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think it's the having to hide your femaleness or motherliness at work. You know, the fact that we go into this working environment where the fact that we have these huge other duties and cares as well, which are to do with, you know, the Kate's mum is constantly interrupting her with kind of, you know, apparently annoying, meaningless kind of phone calls about things while she's supposed to be, you know, pretending to be an office worker. Similarly with the kids. I mean, I think I don't know how she does it. Kate was in a meeting and then she got a call from some clown who was going to be coming to Emily's party. I can't remember the name of the clown, but it's called like something like Mr. Spongy Big Feet or something. And so she was having to say, yes, Mr. Spongy Big Feet, you know, I will be eager to deal with your... So I think it's those moments of overlap. I think also, let's be honest, I think there are moments where the dads and the husbands' strange, weird lack of not noticing anything that's going on or anything that needs doing. I think women very strongly identify with those moments. Kate says that it's impossible to download motherhood into your partner's brain, and that all the noticing that we do. There was one scene in the first book where Kate and the family turn up at her parents-in-law for Christmas, and she's bought all the presents for, you know, their side, and all the presents for everyone else and the kids and so on. And her husband Richard produces a bottle of red wine, for which he is greeted as the risen Christ, basically, you know. And I think that when I was on the tour recently, a couple of women mentioned that as something that had absolutely made them explode with laughter, because it's very familiar. You know, so much is expected. You know, women are expected to kind of be the dog's body, really. And right. I think it's quite nice to have a book which shines a light on that.
Yeah, I was just going to say another great line in this book was the marital we, as in, you know, did we make this phone call yet? Did we do this important thing yet? And that was awesome. I love that, because it's like, he means you.
He means you, yeah. So it's, what have we got my mum for her birthday?
Right.
Would never mean, what have I got my mom for her birthday? It would mean, what have you got my mom for her birthday?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of unpicking that language, really. But as you say, you know, the book has very serious things to say about ageism.
Absolutely.
I mean, I looked up some research which showed that it's the same in the UK, but in the States, that the most discriminated against group in terms of job applications, the least likely to be called for interview, will be older women. That's the fact, you know, that women are hit by the double whammy of being older and female. And that really rankles with me, because one of the things How Hard Can It Be sets out to do, really, is to show the amazing experience and capability that a woman of Kate's age group brings to her life, both work and home.
Right.
And as a banker friend of mine said to me recently, of course I can deal with difficult clients. I'm the mother of 15-year-old twins. and it seems to me that the things we do domestically, which of course are tremendously demanding, and, you know, finding, you know, taking care of your sick mother, or, you know, diffusing arguments between your kids, these are all, you know, these are significant achievements, really, but they have no economic value. They have no commercial value. So you may remember there's a scene in the book where Kate has been told that she has nothing to offer when she tries to get a job.
Right.
And she recasts her resume using all the domestic stuff she's done, and recasts it as kind of business language. So she says, you know, I'm very, very experienced in transportation, brackets, you know, pick up and drop off. And, you know, all the kind of you know, used to handling major targets and deploying my staff in effective ways. And then she says, well, of course I am. You know, I'm a mother.
Right.
So that's a funny, that resume is very funny, but it's also, it's very satirical and pointed. It's saying, if women can do all this stuff, are we seriously trying to say that they're not able to hold down a job after they're 50? It's crazy.
Now, as you did in I Don't Know How She Does It, you offer us a timeline as the book unfolds, and literally it's, you know, the hour of the day. And it struck me that this must have worked in a different way in this book. You know, in the first book, it's got to do with her work schedule. Well, it does here too, but in this book, it's almost like showing us how quickly technology is changing. I don't know. There was just something about it that felt different to me. Did that strike you as you worked?
I think I hesitated over copying that kind of layout of the first book, but I felt it was very true to Kate in terms of always being under time pressure.
Right.
And in fact, one of the lovely things that the first book was translated into 32 different languages, and they came up with lots of different titles, not just I Don't Know How She Does It. And in Swedish, the book is called 28 Hours in 24.
Oh.
And that is the Swedish colloquial term for, you know, the woman who, you know, there's never enough time. So I think that by having that beat of the, you know, hours and minutes going by, that's quite a good way of keeping up the kind of the ratchet of the pressure, you know, tightening. She's also having a countdown to the 50th birthday, which is looming. I mean, she's 49 and a half when we first meet her.
Right.
So she has that, the clock's ticking, literally, towards this thing which she fears is going to mean invisibility and all the things that women fear it will mean.
Right, yeah. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what it was like to have I Don't Know How She Does It become a movie. Were you at all involved in that?
No, I mean, peripherally, but not really. And I think that felt fine too. I'm never sure about being involved in something like that. You know, I think sometimes it's good to hand over to a different kind of expertise. And Aline McKenna was doing the adaptation, and she is, you know, she's a genius. So I was very, very lucky to have her. I did go to the set, and this is the only time I've been truly impressive to my own kids, I think. So the kids were quite small then, and they met Sarah Jessica Parker's husband, Matthew Broderick, they know as Ferris Bueller. So it was like, Mom, we met Ferris Bueller because of your book. So this is suddenly Mummy being an author, sitting in her study being cross. It's like, so I got lots of marks for that. And I did go to the set, and Sarah Jessica Parker was extremely, she's the nicest person. She was extremely sweet and solicitous. I met her a few times. And
yeah.
I met Pierce Brosnan, who plays Jack Abelhammer, the kind of love interest.
Yes.
And Pierce came up to me and has a wonderful Irish lilt. And he said, Alison Pearson, Alison Pearson, Alison Pearson. I thought, you can stand there for 93 years and keep saying that. So, yeah, I mean, it's magical to see something that, you know, you produced in your kind of, you know, messy little study suddenly up on the screen with these, you know, great people bringing it to life. It's I think it's just something any author would just feel very happy and grateful for.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've signed a TV deal for How Hard Can It Be? As you and I were talking earlier, you said it's with the producers of Big Little Lies.
Mm-hmm.
So are they going to cast it differently? Do you know what that's going to look like?
It's very early stages yet, but I'm hoping in the book, Kate, to build up her confidence, goes back to a kind of a group called women called Returners, you know, where there are now increasingly these programs. I think in the States they're called Relaunchers, but over here they're called Returners. Kate goes to the group, which is full of other women who are trying to get their confidence back to re-enter the workplace. And I think that would be a very wonderful center device for a long-running TV series, because you can have, you know, not just Kate, but so many different women who are, you know, whose lives have taken different paths for different reasons, and they're all, you know, like coming together to learn how to make themselves relevant and viable again. And I'm collecting desperately. In fact, on the book tour, I was collecting great stories. That's what I love. You know, every time I meet readers and then people will say, oh, you know, this thing happened to my husband, this thing happened to my sister. And, you know, of course, I'm a shameless cannibal. I just kind of like, I eat off all the stories. One woman gave me a detail, which I'm desperate to get into the TV series. She said that her husband had lost his job and was increasingly desperate to get another job. And she said she'd gone home the other morning and found him over the bath dyeing his hair.
Aww.
And those are the kind of details, you know, because they speak of a whole, you know, emotional experience, don't they?
Yeah.
So we're going to have, I think there's going to be one man in the group. and then, of course, Kate will be front, left and center. And I think we're... what they're thinking of is half-hour episodes along the lines of Sex and the City, possibly narrated by Kate, but with, you know, kind of real, hopefully real substance and passion in them and all the difficulties we've talked about, but also a lot of just wonderful laugh-out-loud moments. That would be the goal.
Now, will you write for that project, or will you have sort of a sort of advisory role?
Well, I'm hoping to write, and they say I can write, which is very exciting. I've never done that, but you know, I do feel when I'm writing the novels that the dialogue scenes come most easily to me.
Mm-hmm.
All the description, I'm like, oh God, can we get some help in here? sometimes feel it would be. I mean, particularly with How Hard Can It Be, because there's so many layers to the story. You're constantly back and forth between, you know, the work and the old people and the kids. And
right.
I found it very, very challenging to write it, I must say. But the dialogue scenes, I just feel so free when I'm writing those scenes. So I think it'll be very exciting to see if I can, you know, use my skill in a new, and I watch a lot of American TV, which I adore anyway. So, and I think it's becoming so wonderful and complex. I mean, I've been watching This Is Us, which is tremendous.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just, these things have novelistic layers of meaning, I think. And Grace and Frankie, which I adore, which again is a very, very bold, you know, tackling the challenges of older women. So I'm hoping this is going to, you know, be a wonderful, like a sort of Golden Girls, but let's lose 20 years kind of thing.
Right.
We should mention one of the devices in the book I'm the most fond of is Kate's always struggling to remember anything because she's going through the menopause. And,
right.
She says, I used to have a brain that was like a state-of-the-art computer retrieval system. She said, now my memory is basically one elderly librarian called Roy.
Right.
And Roy, when she's trying to figure out someone's name or remember the name of a film, she's basically imagining Roy in her memory going to the back of the stacks to try and find the relevant name. And sometimes Roy comes back quickly with the facts, but sometimes he has a cigarette or just kind of disappears for 2 or 3 days and then brings the memory back. And I'm very fond of Roy because I think lots of women readers have come up to me at events in the States and said, hey, I had to ask Roy where it was.
Oh, wouldn't it be fun to cast Roy?
So I thought if we have it in the TV series, I did say to them, I said to the producers, if we could have someone like Stanley Tucci playing Roy, if you like the genie in I Dream of Jeannie, just every so often, you know, turning up to tell her, you know, do you remember where you put the concert tickets? The car keys are over here, you know. So I think that would be a lot of fun.
Oh, that's really fun. I like that. You could even have Roy and Kate rolling their eyes at each other when her husband says, "Did we do such and such?"
You see, I'm going to steal that. Thank you. That's absolutely brilliant. Exactly. Yeah. So also, I think, you know, I think about the book. I mean, obviously, it's very, very explicit about menopause and the difficulties that women go through in a way that I don't think any other book has ever, you know, has even addressed them, really. But it's also a great hymn to female friendship. I mean, I think that one of the things that gets women through at Kate's age is the love and support of her girlfriends. So that's a very, very important strand in this book.
Yeah. Now, if you're going to be working on that, I don't know, are you writing another novel or are you kind of waiting for a little while and see what happens?
Well, as I was traveling on the road, this is the terrible thing, because it's like childbirth, isn't it? And then you think, never again, oh my God. And then tiny little green shoots of sorts have been coming up, and I've been kind of stamping on them as hard as I can. Please go away, I don't need this. But I've had a couple of ideas, and I might. But I think as I'm working, as I'm going to be, you know, trying to help with the TV series, maybe I would be quite tempted to do something that, you know, something shorter, a novella. See if I could write it without it turning into this immense ordeal and strain, which is how these books feel to me, really. I mean, you know, for very funny books, they're not very funny to write. So I'd like to, you know, maybe do something genre would be interesting, I think.
I think sort of like when we can't recall a memory, I think when you're not working at it, that's when Roy brings it back. And it's funny, as you're working on the TV show, I wonder if you won't have lots of novel ideas.
You know, I think that's right. And it was interesting that being on this book tour, hopping from city to city, when my mind is so rarely in neutral, okay, it's so rarely, is it not flooded with all the stuff that Kate's is flooded with, you know, my mom and the kids, and, right. You know, what about this, what about that? And I think suddenly having these kind of times where I was just on my own and not just being able to read other people's books, which is fabulous, but just allowing the ideas to bubble up. So I hate to say yes, but I may well, if I decided I'm going to do it, I don't want to sell it first. I don't want to have any burden of expectation. It would simply be, you know, here it is. See if
for
anyone
you.
Likes it or not. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned maybe on the book tour having a little time to read other people's work. Have you read anything lately that you might recommend to listeners?
Well, I'm a judge of a fiction prize here in England, which finds unpublished female authors, women of all ages. And we've been having some fantastic success with that, finding some amazing women. And I just reading this great novel by an American woman. I'm going to get the name wrong. Kelly Jefferson Greenberg, and her first novel, Swan Song, which is about the women in Truman Capote's life. I've just been reading that with enormous pleasure.
Oh, wow.
And I was reading, a friend had given me that wonderful factual book, which one of your surgeons published over there, who very tragically had the terminal diagnosis,
right.
When Breath Becomes Air.
Yes, yeah.
Which I loved. I'm starting the new Meg Wolitzer, because I'm a huge, huge fan of ever since The Wife. Meg's amazing, amazing novel. And then, of course, she published The Interestings, and now there's the new one, which I've started with kind of bated breath. You know, that lovely feeling when you know you're going to be in great hands of a writer who entertains you and provokes you and so on.
Right.
So, and I brought back from the States for Father's Day John Updike collected golf writings, which has gone down a big storm with the we're big Updike fans in this house.
Yeah.
So that was a reminder of one of the great writers we absolutely adore. So many books.
Yeah, I did get to interview Meg Wolitzer. She was on the show for her young adult book that came out a few years ago that actually takes place in Vermont. So that was fun to talk to her.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was fun.
I think she is quite something. And I have to say that of my favorite writers, I would say that the American women writers and the North American women writers, I mean, Laurie Moore, Carol Shields, Ann Tyler, I mean, this is this has been a rich, rich era for great American female writing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, Allison, I have just one last question for you, and that is, I like to finish up by asking if authors have advice. I'm wondering if you have advice for people who write books that use humor to draw attention to more serious themes, but also maybe in particular advice for female writers.
Right. Okay. So let me think what my advice would be. Right. Aline, my friend, the screenwriter, said her dad once, when she was, you know, worrying about writing something, he said, Aline, put your ass on the chair.
Yeah.
So the first piece of advice is put your ass on the chair, because wandering around thinking you're going to write something is not going to get writing. And so start typing. Keep a file. I've got a file on my computer which is called Must, M-U-S-T. Any little thing that I see, you see on the news, in the papers, an observation a friend makes, just write it down and get it in that file, okay? Because you will use it. And then, if you've got that, if you've overheard a bit of dialogue on the train or whatever, come back, write the bit of dialogue down, and then expand it. That's what I do. I just hear something that's made me laugh or made me wince, and I just write it down, and then I just gently fill it out. You know, he said, she said, he said, there were trees outside the window. Just so you give yourself. So when I'm going through the book, I have these little passages that are written already, and they give me a confidence that I've got material that's good that I can inject in, you know?
Yeah.
A simple trick is basically when you're writing a novel, somebody needs to want to find out what happens. This is, you know, if it doesn't have a narrative pulse, it's not going to work. So at the end of each chapter, actually look at what you've written and then add a line saying something like, but what, you know, how bad would it be on Thursday? Would she manage to, you know, get the car out of the river? It doesn't matter, whatever it is, just put it in, okay? Put it in, because the basic thing of the reader thinking, yeah, did she manage to get the car out of the river? This is what makes people read on. So you can have that kind of, you know, have those moments of actually looking and thinking, right, why would I want to turn the page?
Right.
You know, what about this has made me think, you know, I'm really, and also a great friend, actually, my American friend I was staying with recently, she's writing a novel at the moment. And, you know, I said to her, it's got fantastic things in it. She needs to be really invested in that character from the get-go, you know,
right
from the first two pages. Who is this person? Why are we, maybe two people, maybe three people, why are we interested in them? Why should we care about them enough? Make the reader care. That's what I would say. At least either be interested, you know, care about their fate, but also, you know, what happens next? The basic primitive narrative beat, what happens next? Make sure that's there.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's fantastic advice. Lots of good advice, so that's great.
And I should probably say as well that there are certain writers I will always let their books flip open at any page. Like Nora Ephron is my go-to person. And if I'm really struggling, I just let, I'll let Heartburn or I Feel Bad About My Neck. I'll just let it fall open. And there's Nora's voice to help me.
Yeah.
Like she's saying, this is how you're funny. This is how you're funny. And I think, yeah, thank you. Thank you. I think that having a favorite author, someone whose work you really admire, keeping that on your desk, and if you get a bit stuck, just let the page fall open somewhere, read a couple of paragraphs, and kind of give your brain that kind of boost of thinking, yeah, that's how it's done. You know, even simple things like how do you begin a paragraph? It's just very, very, I find it very, very helpful.
Okay, that's fantastic. The book is How Hard Can It Be? It's written by Allison Pearson and published by St. Martin's Press. Allison, I really enjoyed speaking with you today. Thank you so much for talking to me when you're jet-lagged and exhausted and just barely home.
It was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Allison Pearson. We discussed her new novel, How Hard Can It Be?, published by St. Martin's Press. You can follow her on Twitter at Allison Pearson, and that's AllisonPearson. Today's Write the Book prompt comes from the interview you just heard with Allison Pearson, who says that she likes to help readers feel the narrative pulse by adding a line at the end of each chapter that helps the reader along. So for an example, would she get the car out of the river? Offer the reader the reason to go on. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I've said before, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, tweet about it, tell all your friends. The other thing I want to mention is that I was away for a couple weeks and I had the pleasure of walking part of El Camino in northern Spain with some friends. Took a lot of audio files and pictures, and I'm going to put together a slideshow and audio with the slideshow that'll be up on the podcast site within the next week or so. And at some point on the show, I will play the sounds of El Camino, so you can tune in and hear that as well. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.